A big gun sale goes terribly wrong, but luckily no one was injured. It's a British film, so they all just decided to talk it out over tea, which makes for a truly quiet, introspective, and relaxing film. So much so that it's almost meditative. Almost.
Howdy, I'm Jeff Goldsmith, and this is the Q&A. My agenda is simple. Each week, I plan to bring you in-depth insight into the creative process of storytelling. You know, this was a fun one, because I got to chat about Free Fire with co-writer-director Ben Wheatley, and Ben also co-edited the film, and the only way this interview could have gone better would have been if Amy Jump was there. That's Ben's wife, and she co-wrote and co-edited the film with him. And really, I've always found it cool that this married team of filmmakers has a great working relationship with each other and truly seems to love what they're doing. In fact, you'll hear later in the interview that Ben has such reverence for his wife's writing that after she rewrites him on this film, that was the final word. He didn't change anything she wrote, which is a really cool insight into their process as well. The film is opening wide today, so I hope you'll go see it to support independent cinema in theaters and let your viewing preferences be known at the box office, because that's where you have the power. Ben had a lot of great things to say about his process and what it took to get this film in the can, so I know you'll dig this episode. But first, I have a question for you. Are you crazy enough to write your own screenplay? This episode is sponsored by the fine folks at screencraft.org. Screencraft specializes in screenwriting competitions by genre, tailoring the prize package and the Hollywood jury specifically to each genre contest. I am pleased to announce the 2017 comedy and horror contests are both open for script submissions now. Also open for submissions, the annual Screencraft Screenwriting Fellowship, which offers writers the opportunity to mentor with four Academy Award-winning screenwriters and producers, as well as top studio executives, agents, and managers. You can enter any and all Screencraft writing competitions in 2017 with the exclusive 10% discount coupon code QAPODCAST. That's QAPODCAST, all one word, to save your 10% on your entry. Remember, you can learn all about the horror and comedy contests along with the fellowship too over at www.screencraft.org, so I hope you check it out. And hey, while you're surfing around on the web, I hope you'll also check out my digital magazine Backstory on the iPad. It is the place to go for amazing television, film, and theater content. Remember, for you non-iPad folks, stay tuned to www.backstory.net for updates, because soon enough it'll become the fully functional magazine. And guess what? I have great news. We just launched the new Backstory app for iPads, and it has a new interface, and that interface is going to be exactly mirrored on our website. And I've seen the web version in action. It looks and reads fantastically. So we're now in the final stages of testing and ready to launch a nice new homepage soon. And once it's active, you will finally be able to read Backstory on the web. And by the way, not just some of Backstory, all of it. When you subscribe on the web, which is different from subscribing on the tablet, even though the two are married together, so don't worry about it if you're already a tablet subscriber. But when you subscribe on the web, your subscription includes the entire library of everything that we've published. So if you're going to be a new subscriber, I highly recommend you subscribe on the web first, and then we'll be able to show you how to link it up to your tablet. But please stay tuned, as we are ready to roll out our web functionality very soon. As you know, you can read us right now on iPads, and soon we're going to be available on any tablet that supports Google Play as well. So we're expanding on tablets too. And right around the corner, issue 27, our Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 issue is going to be timed with the release of the film. But right now, available is issue 26. Our Oscar issue is still our current issue, so if you have an iPad, please check it out. In issue 26, you could read Oscar scripts, articles with all the nominees, including the winners. You could also read the full Blacklist screenplay Burn Run, learn what it took for James Mangold to get Logan made, hear from Gary Whitta about writing Rogue One, and tons more, so I hope you check out issue 26, our Oscar issue. Of course, if you're so inclined, you could buy an issue or subscribe on your iPad, so thanks for considering. And remember, while you're fiddling around online, if you have a script ready to enter into the comedy, horror, or fellowship competitions over at www.screencraft.org, I hope you'll check out the site, and remember to save 10% on your entry by using your discount coupon code QAPODCAST. But now, without any further ado, let's jump right into a posh Beverly Hills hotel room where good old co-writer-director Ben Wheatley was hanging out and ready to chat about his latest film, Free Fire. Ben Wheatley, how's it going?
Good, thanks. How you doing?
You're good. You're wearing orange socks, no shoes. You're kicking back. You're at the end of the press day here. I think you're comfortable.
I am, yeah. You're lucky that I'm not. I've been doing all the phone interviews lying on that bed, but I thought it would just be weird to do the podcast on the bed.
It would be like a psychiatrist visit, kind
of. Yeah, it's nice lying down. I've done a lot of press lying down. It's really good.
That's a good way to go. Well, so look, I want to get people to get a grounding for you.
Oh, yeah.
And to my knowledge, your kind of breaking in story, your first stuff was in 2007, there was Comedy Shuffle. And then Modern Toss in 2008. So you were kind of grounded coming up in TV.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, what are some of the fundamentals as a writer and director going up the ranks in television that you think helped prepare you for feature films?
I think the main thing was the discipline of television, where basically there's no overtime. So there's no going over. So
really?
In UK TV, yeah. So you hit, if you're doing, you know, 8 till 7, and you don't go 1 minute over 7, you end at 7. So you need to know what you're doing, and you need to be able to get through all the stuff you need to get through. Maybe it's not so onerous, you know, on a decent budget British TV stuff, you're probably doing, I don't know, like 8-7 pages or something a day, which is, you know, it's a reasonable amount.
That's moving along.
Yeah, that's fast for film. And I did TV shows which, like comedies, which had a lot of people in them, which is nerve-wracking, you know, if you've got to do eyelines for like 9 people talking in a room, moving and blocking and stuff. So you need to be confident, you need to get through it as fast as possible and be right. There's no going back and there's no reshoots and none of that stuff. And whatever you do on that day is going to go on the TV and with your name on it. So that was the big one for me. And I've taken all that decisiveness and blocking experience and applied that to my film work.
Well, so in 2009 was your first film, Down Terrace, and I really enjoyed it. And I'm curious, kind of just to encapsulate briefly through a trial by fire, what was your biggest takeaway? What was your biggest lesson as both a writer and a director on that kind of helped prepare you as you were going along to other features?
That film was... The way I'd come to it was like my agent had said, oh, you know, I'd asked my agent I want to do drama. And I'd been and done a lot of comedy. And they said, and he said, well, if you do a short film, a drama short film, they'll let you do drama on TV. I was like, what, really? I have to do a short film? That, you know, so I thought, I hate short films. I'll do a feature length film. And everyone's like, don't do that. That's mad. And I was like, oh. So I kind of sat down and I thought about it. And I thought, like, well, you know, in set up a kind of series of rules for it, and one of them was that a soccer match is a feature film. It's a 90-minute TV experience, which is shot multiple camera and one take. So there's that. Then you've got something like, I don't know, Primer, the Maisel's Pennebaker documentary, and that's 3 days of shooting, which is a feature film. I was like, wow, that's 3 days, and it's a feature film. So I want to make a feature film. I can shoot for more than 3 days. They managed it in 3 days, so maybe I should be able to manage it in... And then we looked at the maths and thought, well, how much can a freelancer afford to take off in a month but still manage to pay their mortgage? So we reckon 8 days was the most you could afford not to work. So we asked our friends, Andy Starkano is the producer, asked our friends who were technicians and said, who wants to do this? Who wants to come with this for 8 days and we'll make a feature film and we'll shoot it like a documentary and it'll be done. And we got all our guys together and basically those guys are the same guys it's the same crew that we've used all the way through to Free Fire. And we did it, you know, and we shot it like it was, I said, the only way we'll survive this is if we imagine this is a documentary rather than a drama. And it's all shot handheld. And I used the blocking experience I had on the TV thing to move as fast as possible, all done on stopwatches and stuff. And I guess the roundabout way of answering your question is that the takeaway from it for me was that you should never ask permission. You should never think that the hierarchy is built there to help you move through it. You need to the way through is to storm the castle. You know, you kick the door in, you don't ask to go in. And we were all complete outsiders, no connection really in cinema at all. And we made the movie, and it was the smartest 8 days you know, spent I've ever spent in my life. You know, from that moment on, it completely changed my whole trajectory of my career, you know.
Well, and everything you just said about television came back for you to your advantage, in which you were used to doing a lot of pages a day. You were used to keeping things moving. So that's how you could get a feature on, you know, in the can in 8 days, which is crazy.
But it's not, you know, and it never felt like a massive struggle when we made it. And then subsequently, I made stuff in, you know, Field in England was done in 12 days. And that wasn't, they never stood there going, oh my God, we need more time. It was all fine, you know. So I think it's totally reasonable to shoot that quick. And in a way, why films actually take a long time or used to take a long time was because the film wasn't, you know, it wasn't fast enough. So that the
right.
So you need a load of lights, and then the lights take ages.
And you needed to change your mags and everything else.
Blah, blah, blah. Yeah. So really, you've got to look at on those movies, how long were they spending with the actors, filming the actors? And when on TV, you know, I was shooting half hour in 5 days. But I reckon I spent as much time with the actors on Down Terrace as I did on the 8 weeks that I shot a TV series.
Briefly, I've always loved Kill List, and, you know, I'm a longtime fan of the original Wicker Man. I'm just kind of pretending that Neil Abute and Nick Cage never had seen Wicker Man or did anything in between. But you clearly have a love for Wicker Man as well. And it's an interesting kind of case study in which you didn't do any sort of an official remake, but you by all means possibly let something that influenced you inhabit the story in its own way. And I'm just kind of curious, just for fans, if that was part of your approach, or do you not see it like that at all?
No, I mean, I think the thing about Wicker Man is interesting from an American perspective, right? You've got, if you're looking at a movie and you look around to find the culture that fits that movie, and you go, oh, well, Wicker Man, yeah, okay, well, that matches this in some respects. But in Europe, this is living culture. It's around us. It's not a thing. It's not a film. It's real, you know, and standing stones and pagan stuff and all that stuff is all is all around. So it's that point of reference is not a cinematic point of reference. It's a cultural point of reference. So when that movie is not necessarily Kill This is not necessarily looking to Wicker Man only, or it's looking.
But it was an influence, surely. Well, with that ending, it's hard to say it wouldn't be, right?
No, I think, well, or you could, that ending is also the ending of Planet of the Apes, isn't it? If you're going to go there, or Parallax View, more.
Parallax View, yeah.
It's much, the Parallax View ending is much closer, you know, so, you know. My point is, it's not that films aren't always referencing other films. Films reference culture to more of a degree, but when your only point of reference to that culture is another film, that's the first place you'll go, you know.
Makes sense. And by the way, I love the film, so I just, as a Wicker fan, I had to ask. Sightseers was a film that you didn't write for the first time, and I just actually had Alice Lowe for Prevenge. We did a Q&A screening, and I love Sightseers, and Prevenge was great. I'm sure you love it as well. And I'm just kind of curious for you what that experience was like. Was that something you want to do more of in your career, to occasionally just direct something? Or obviously you're back to writing now.
Well, the thing is, the film fits really well within the movies I've done because Amy did a massive rewrite on it.
Amy Jump, yeah.
So it's similar to the other movies because of that, you know.
But I'm specifically talking about your writing, Maestro. Yeah.
Well, I'm not, you know, my writing is come out of necessity, you know. It's not like I'm very pragmatic about it, you know. If it can be done by someone else better, then they'll do it, you know. And certainly with the way that Amy rewrites my stuff, you know, that's how we work. You know, it's not going backwards and forwards and discussing it. It's like she'll take a script and then just reconfigure it, you know. And I'll look at it and go, that's fine. You know, I'm not going to fight it because often what she does is loads better. So, and I have no ego in that particularly. And I like I think it's more the, I know what a story I want is, and I know the ins and outs of it, but the sharpness of thought within her dialogue is beyond the stuff that I write often.
And we're going to talk more in depth about your writing in a second, and I would love to talk more about Sightseers, but I just don't have the time, damn it. So I'm going to get straight to Free Fire.
All right.
You know, there's this feeling a little bit of Reservoir Dogs, in which it's a bunch of criminals kind of not getting along so well in a single location that's abandoned. So that kind of has a great resonance. And I'm just kind of curious how the idea for this deal gone wrong started with Free Fire. And I'm sure no one has asked you this in the last 24 hours. No. So.
Well, luckily, I damaged myself so much when I was a teenager by smoking marijuana that I my recall is so short that each of these questions strikes me as being brand new and exciting.
Very good.
And I approach it in a fresh way each time.
I see your toes wiggling.
Yeah, I'm thinking. This is my thinking sock. Yeah, it started with research I was doing into a film in the 90s, which was a crime film. Rob Hill, who's the co-writer on Down Terrace, had found a transcript of an FBI shootout that had happened in Miami, and it was basically a blow-by-blow account of the FBI taking down like these armed bank robbers.
Where did he find it? Where does
online.
One find it?
It was online.
Really?
Yeah, it's still kicking around somewhere, I'm sure. And it's crazy. You know, it's like really chaotic. It's, not, you know, highly trained police officers not being able to hit the side of a barn at close range. And not like any Hollywood thing you've ever seen, you know. And I thought this is really interesting. And I started reading up on other police transcripts and police experience of being in gunfights and stuff. And everyone was saying that what goes out the window almost immediately is like people can be amazingly good on the range and bang, 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 bullseyes all day long and do trick shots and all this stuff. But as soon as people are firing back, it all goes completely out the window and everyone's terrified and everything's really scrappy. And unless you're like some kind of crazy Delta Force, Special Forces dude who's firing off thousands of rounds a day and practicing and practicing and practicing and being in loads of combat, most people just go to pieces straight away. And certainly the characters of this are just all in Free Fire are just, they're not hardly trained in any way. So they're, you know, and that was the other thing I think it's like, you know, there's the whole bad rap that the stormtroopers get in Star Wars, you know, it's kind of realistic, you know. They wouldn't be able to shoot straight if they were being fired at, you know, unless they were like highly, highly, highly trained. So that was the beginning of it, you know, to take an action movie, all the tropes from an action movie, and then just boil them down into close combat, close personal and human scale action.
You co-wrote it with Amy Jump, and I just want to talk about your creative habit for a second. When you guys write together, do you write in the same room, or do you send drafts back and forth?
No, we do. I'll write the draft. I'll write a first, second, third draft, and then she'll take it away and rewrite it, and that's it.
So you don't go back with her. So you stay separate, essentially.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
We don't talk about it either.
Really?
Yeah. And then on this one was
you
like
you don't talk about it.
No.
Interesting. So you just read each other's drafts to see like, oh, I see what she did there.
Yeah, so she'll read my draft and then she'll just rewrite. So every line of dialogue was replaced in Free Fire.
But you don't rewrite her for a final? Interesting.
No. Wouldn't dare.
Interesting. I've never heard of that, but good for you. So when you sit down to write, how important is outlining to your process?
Well, I've got different things I've developed from reading the terrible script writing books. But my thing is... I write 1 to 30 on 3 bits of paper, and then I write a sentence for each of the numbers. So if I can write out 90 sentences, then I've got a movie usually. So the sentence, and then you take the 1 to 30s and you make them into 1 to 15s, and you expand each sentence out into a paragraph. And then you take that, it becomes the treatment, which is the whole film, and then you format it to script format. And then you start dropping the character names in with the big lumps of description, and then you flip those lumps of description into dialogue.
But are you saying in the 1 to 30, do you mean like there's 30 different scenes or sequences that inform the film?
Sentences that are covering a minute.
Okay.
So it'd be like...
And when you go from 1 to 30 to 1 to 15, what exactly do you mean by that?
Well, the 1 to 15 is just doubling it up. So you've gone from sentences, you then go to paragraphs.
Okay.
But you can't fit 1 to 30 paragraphs on a piece of paper.
Right,
so
right.
You go half again. And then you keep going until you've got single pages.
So how many pages would you say that treatment is when you're looking at it?
Well, the beginning it's 3 pages.
Well, yes.
And then it becomes 6 pages. And then it keeps going until it becomes 90
pages.
Don't
ever ask me to do math.
Yeah. That's my
just
worst.
Doubles each
yes,
time.
Yes, yeah. Okay, fair. So it just doubles each time. That's simple. Yeah. Sounded complicated, but it's very simple.
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward. And you can write like Billy-O if you do that. You can knock out script after script after script. And also, you don't get into a dead end with this kind of writing, because if you can't fill the numbers out, then you just dump it because you've got no story.
Interesting. Well, and you're still considering the three-act structure, so you're safe in that regard.
And actually, the 30-30-30 is the old way, because that's the Sid Field structure, which also can go 30-60-30. But the McKee one, which is, I think is more realistic, is more like, 30-40-10 or something like
that. Right, I thought you were talking 1 to 30 total, so it was 10-10-10, and I was like, that doesn't make
sense.
No,
that doesn't make sense. Yeah,
now I got you. But
I'm more of a believer in the short third act.
Okay, yeah. Wrap it up. Get him out.
Well, yeah. Yeah, it makes much more sense, but most movies have that, so.
Well, so do you give yourself a page count once you're scripting to hit each day, or do you prefer to have a certain amount of hours to write?
What I have is mistress projects. So I start with the script, and then I'll have a mistress, and the mistress has a mistress, and the mistress has a mistress, and then I'll bounce back to the, if I become guilty enough from having all these mistresses, I'll bounce back to the original script and get back onto that. So I'll probably at any one time be writing up to two or three scripts. Then I might have a script I have to write that I've been paid for, and I'll jump onto that one occasionally when I feel the pressure of people have paid me, going to phone me up and scare me. So there's that. And in between that, I usually play video games.
What games do you like to play?
Counter-Strike.
Okay, nice. So how long did it take you to get the first draft of Free Fire?
It probably wasn't long. I don't know, 2 weeks.
2 weeks, even with all those mistresses?
Yeah, man. You got to spend time with the mistresses. They keep you young.
All right. That makes sense. What do you do if you get writer's block? It sounds like you're just jumping back and forth, mistress to mistress. So.
No, you don't. No, I don't get writer's block.
You don't?
No.
Good man. That's unusual. But that's good. That's
good.
I hear that from a lot of TV writers too. So I mean, like, because the impetus of TV keeps you moving so fast that a lot of TV writers say that there just isn't time for writer's block. So that it seems like your original training is kicking in again.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean you're not necessarily just writing a load of old toot, though. That's the other thing. It's kind of, it can just be bad, but I can always write something, you know, and just keep going.
Well, something really key here is, how does your action look on the page? Because the thing in Free Fire is there's so much ballistically going on with bullets bouncing off walls, hitting people in certain ways, a lot of overlapping dialogue, some of which clearly was, you know, a part of post, so it seemed. How did you do that? Did you use like the final draft function of side by side action?
Yeah, but that doesn't really work. That's really hard.
No?
They're hard to edit. That side by side thing. It's almost like Final Draft has got a problem with Howard Hawks, and it refuses you to do overlapping dialogue like you would get in those bringing up baby and stuff like that. It's really irritating. But it is action wise. We're trying to work out how to write action and to make it. Because there's action in scripts that screenwriters write, and it's very prosaic, and it reads like, I love American scripts. They were such a brilliant read, but they're mostly useless for the actual making of the film, you know, in terms of how these things translate into pictures. It's the script, you know, a really nicely written script which really reads well is more like a book or something. It's nothing to do with filmmaking, I don't think. And so I've been trying to work this out, and it's really irritating. And so we've been doing stuff like writing scripts and then storyboarding the whole film and then writing about the storyboards rather than writing about what you want to be in the storyboards. Because the act of storyboarding is closer to the discipline of the filmmaking, and so you don't fall back on all the lazy shit that you can do in a script that is unfilmable.
That's interesting. So storyboarding is almost a rewriting process for you, without a doubt.
Yeah.
Okay. In which your dialogue is basically locked, but you'll lose some of it when you realize you could do things visually, it would seem.
Maybe so, but it's the commitment to doing the boards more than two or three times as well. And it's not just the action, it's everything. So,
more than two or three times?
Yeah, yeah. So I think on Free Fire, I definitely did them three times. And they would have been, I guess the first set was maybe 800 drawings, and then, and by the end of it, it was about 1,700 to 2,000.
Do you work with a group of storyboard artists? Do you draw them yourself?
No, I draw them myself.
Wow, that's impressive.
On this one, I had less time, so the last draft of the boards were scrappy, and I got some guy to redraw them. But on high rise, they're all drawn by me, and all the projects I'm doing and the other projects where I've got more time, I'll draw them myself.
500 pyro detonations, 6,000 rounds of ammo during production. What, just briefly, because I want to get to spoilers in a second, because I know we're in our last 10 minutes, what's something that's really important that you learned as a director that you want to impart to kind of younger directors for working in these kind of action sequences? Because safety is really important, and you worked with a lot of gunplay.
I don't know. I mean, you know, that no one should ever get hurt making a movie. It's too much of a trivial pursuit. You know, I would be very sad if someone was injured on one of my movies. So I don't, you know, any amount of health and safety, I move delicately around this stuff, you know. And, you know, I've been really lucky that no one, you know, we've done stuff that there is an element of risk.
But modern filmmakers often are imparting on digital effects for their gunfire, and you were using mostly practical.
Yeah.
So that's, I'm not saying it's a lost art by any means, but it definitely needs some more delicacy.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the using like CG muzzle flashes and deactivated replica pistols is fine and you know, but certainly safer and quicker and cheaper, but it doesn't look the same, you know.
Yeah. Ooh, hey, I'm cutting in really quick to remind you all about my digital magazine, Backstory. It's an iPad magazine that focuses on the art and business of storytelling. Currently, we're an iPad-only magazine, but fear not, we're coming to the web very soon. You could check out www.backstory.net for updates. All of our issues have been converted, and we're now trying to make the technology active so you could read it on the web, and I can't wait for you to see the web rendition quite soon. I think we're also going to be available for Android tablets for the first time, so more on that when I find out. But right now, issue 26, our Oscar issue, is our current issue, and if you have an iPad, you could check it out, and I hope you will. We did this really cool thing that we've been doing for a few years. It's in our Oscar Lessons section, where we have this year's Oscar-nominated screenwriters tell us about their favorite scene, their toughest scene, a deleted scene they missed, and also what it took to craft their memorable openings and endings for their screenplays. And not only do they tell us this, we publish the scenes they're talking about right there as well. And you also have the entire script to read if you'd like to, too. This year's Oscar Lessons participants include the writers of Arrival, Hell or High Water, Hidden Figures, La La Land, Lion, Manchester by the Sea, and Moonlight. We also interviewed Lin-Manuel Miranda about creating his Oscar-nominated song for Moana, and Justin Hurwitz about his 3 Oscar nominations for the music of La La Land. Plus, Oscar-nominated cinematographer Linus Sandgren on shooting La La Land, along with Roger Ross Williams for his Oscar-nominated documentary, Life Animated. You could also read the full Blacklist screenplay Burn Run, along with an interview by its writer, Matt Tente, and read about what it took to create the popular graphic novel, Mayday. There's also full Sundance coverage, plus TV articles that include Zal Batman-Lige and Britt Marling on creating Netflix's The OA. Scribe Steve Melching and Henry Gilroy chat about writing on Star Wars Rebels. Gary Whitta tells us about his experience on Rogue One. And last but not least, co-writer-director James Mangold fills us in on what it took to close Wolverine's cinematic storyline with Logan. Plus, there's plenty of other pieces to explore as well, so don't miss this fantastic packed issue. And I can't wait to hear your feedback on it. Remember, if you have an iPad, the app and issue 1 are both still free, and each individual issue costs less than a beer at a hipster bar. So treat yourself. And hey, while you're surfing around online, I hope you'll also visit this episode's sponsor, screencraft.org, to see all the great contests they're currently running, including the comedy, horror, and fellowship competitions, which are open for script submissions. And remember, if you use discount coupon code QAPODCAST, all one word, you could save 10% off your entry with QAPODCAST. Right over at www.screencraft.org. And look, I really appreciate all your help in spreading the word about and supporting my passion project, Backstory. But now, let's jump right back into our posh hotel room to hear more about co-writer, director Ben Wheatley's passion project, Free Fire. Strangest thing about your directing for this movie that not many people could say is that it seems to me like 90% of the movie, you were directing actors on the ground. Which is really a kind of thing that you don't see so much. You got these great low camera angles. You were really getting your backgrounds behind them, but there is crawling and sitting and leaning for most of your movie, but it has a kineticism to it that's not really just from the editing or, you know, the gunplay, because there's an intimacy when you get that close to the ground. A lot of movies use it kind of as a punctuation point when somebody's on the ground, but these characters are on the ground for most of the movie. So what was the difficult thing that you learned about keeping it
it fresh shot to shot, but being so close to the ground for most of the movie.
I mean, a lot of that was in the art design, and the space was initially treated as two spaces, even though it's one, and it's the set standing up and the set on the ground is two different places in a way. And we broke the ground into sectors so that they would always be interesting and different as they move through in terms of lighting and in terms of like materials or whatever. So a lot of care was taken with that, and the set was kind of designed as well that you could get closer and closer to stuff and it would become more and more interesting.
Would you need to dig down to put the camera that low? Or no. Would it be on a crane or just handheld that low?
It's all sorts. We used every trick in the book. You know, there was Steadicam, Technicrane,
okay,
handheld, easy rig.
Because, you know, you see those shots of like Citizen Kane where they like dug through the floor of the studio, you know, to get those really, really low angles.
Yeah.
No, but, so you didn't have to dig down at all?
No. Okay. That stuff was all right. But, you know, we used GoPros and planted cameras and Blackmagic.
You used GoPros?
Yeah.
That could get resolution that high?
Yeah. Well, the stuff was fired across the room at people was GoPro.
Oh, okay. Got it.
Yeah,
got
yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's... You know, I've been talking to people and going, oh, you know, this is it 70s influence, blah, blah, blah. And you go, well, look, this film is shot in only a way that could be shot now. You know,
right.
it's digital. It's lots and lots of cameras. Sometimes we're shooting up to 6 cameras. It's tons and tons and tons of rushes. And it was also cut live as well. So the rushes straight into Abbey.
It was cut live?
Yeah, on the set.
And like TV switching?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So by the time they were coming off the set, on cut, within about 10 seconds it was cut, edited in.
And then how long was your editorial process after the movie?
About 2 months.
Okay. Scorsese was an executive producer, and I'm just curious, did he ever give you any interesting notes before we get to our spoilers? Anything that resonated with you? Because the guy's a legend.
Yeah, I mean, he was. It was clarity stuff in terms of sound. He was most hard on.
Sound?
Yeah.
Not story?
No.
So no notes from your early draft before you guys are going to shoot?
No.
Interesting. Okay. What was the Scorsese sound note then?
Oh, just general, you know, story point stuff of just making sure it's clear, you know, and then...
Oh, the dialogue, he might not have been able to hear it over the gunfire.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And it's the first film that we've committed to a lot of ADR. Every other movie, I think in High Rise, there's only like 2 lines of dialogue replacement in it. And this, it was probably like half of it, you know.
Your schedule was 6 weeks. What was your budget?
£5.5 million, which I think at the current money is about eight million.
Yeah, 8 or 9. Yeah. All right. So for our spoilers, any podcast listeners still like
if they've got this far,
that hasn't seen the movie, press pause, go see the movie, and come back. I'm going to jump right into it. Like the central argument between the villains is that Steve-O, quote unquote, bottled Harry's cousin.
Yeah,
and you know it's a vile act, of course. It's a huge accusation, but he's very adamant that he didn't do it.
Yeah.
And by the middle of the movie, once everybody is firing weapons at each other because of it, he seems to take ownership over it, in which maybe just to fuel on Harry.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious, from your perspective, did Steve-O actually do something, or is he a mistaken guy at a bar?
Well, he's definitely been in the bar because of the match box, the matchbook that's left, you know, that's dropped. So I don't know. I think he didn't do it because I think that he's just an agent of chaos and he just loves it, you know. And he's just a swine.
And it's mistaken identity that gets out of hand.
Maybe. Or because I wouldn't trust Harry for anything. He's an idiot.
You have a lot of shifting alliances. Mm. And obviously the biggest reveal is that Martin and Brie Larson's character are...
Justine.
Those two have sold out the group.
Yeah.
They hired snipers. They wanted to
which, by the way, is
the
world's stupidest plan.
Well, especially the way those guys were situated in the room, it didn't seem like those two were going to get out.
It wasn't going to work out. And those two are terrible as well. You know, they're obviously, you know, you call them snipers, but they're just drunk guys from the bar that they got in. Because they've got, what I like about those two is that they have their rifles from their service, you know. So they're Second World War guys, these two, and they're just rubbish.
they were pretty bad freelancers, as they're called. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious, at what point did you know that was going to be kind of the gimmick of what's coming down on them? It's not an external source, it's an internal source of someone within the group betraying.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Was that an early idea?
Oh yeah, that was in the first draft, yeah.
Okay. And you obviously have Ord shifting a lot. He's friends with Vernon, he's friends with Harry, then they're against each other.
what was it like to manage those alliances? Because you have a very big ensemble situation going on where it's really almost impossible to pin anybody as a protagonist.
Yeah.
In so much as you're more recording and telling a story of a situation.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I think that does happen, you know, that these alliances would switch moment to moment. You know, there's a lot of different kind of narratives going on between the different characters. And I think that's, but the thing is, if you look at it, it's kind of a symmetrical war movie, and they're kind of rare where you see it from both sides of the conflict, and you're kind of rooting for all sides, but then it just makes it much more of a tragedy, you know.
I love the balance of comedy and action and drama as well. But you know, the John Denver stuff was pretty out there with the 8 tracks. Mm. The music was coming into the right times. How did you choose John Denver?
Again, it was in the script from the start, and it was, I've got a kind of policy with music that it has to be, I have to like it and I have to listen to it. It's not like a...
So are you a John Denver fan?
Yeah, but not like I've got a John Denver room in my house with John Denver memorabilia, but I love Annie's song a lot, yeah. So, you know, and and it's a similar thing to the characters. I always like the characters in the films, and I don't take a position above them that, you know, even though I say they're stupid, I would say that about myself as much as anything else, you know. So it's kind of, you've got to like, for me, it's important that you like the music that you put into the movie.
Well, there's this great moment when Ord and Chris are walking out together, mm. and he says, you know, you're a John Denver fan. I'll tell you a story about John Denver. Mm. And he never gets to finish the story.
Yeah.
Did you have an actual story, damn it? That's what I want to know.
No.
Okay. That's an easy way to get out of it.
No, Army did ask me about this because he said he's being asked it a lot. And so I knew there is a John Denver story, which is a John Denver rumor, which is crushed by Snopes. So it's not real, but it's interesting. And they'd said he was someone had made up some nonsense that he was a sniper.
Interesting. That fits in well.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's just absolute not true. Absolute lies.
I like that.
But it got out of hand and people talking about it a lot. Yeah.
And Snopes had to get involved.
Yeah, yeah, they had to clear it up.
Snopes.com will always save the day. You know, it's interesting at the end, Justine seems to be getting away.
Yeah.
The femme fatale, and you could see the reflection of, you know, police lights coming in through the garage.
Yeah.
Was that always your ending point? Did you have somebody else maybe getting away? Because it seems like there's so many variables with such a rich ensemble that I'm just curious, what were some of the earlier takes that you had?
No, it was always that.
Okay. It was always that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And but, you know, the thing is, as we've learned from Breaking Bad, the flashing of red lights and sirens does not always denote the arrival of the cops.
True.
It could be the fire department, which would make more sense, to be honest.
And she's just a victim hobbling out with a suitcase that she would hide for later.
And a rifle, unfortunately. So she'd have to get rid of that. So, you know, there's that. I mean, it's not necessarily as bleak as in the world of Free Fire. Who knows what the...
Does that mean there could be Free Fire 2 still firing?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, Bree, in the world of them making up their own backstories and stuff, Bree thought that maybe Justine escaped with the money and then put on a production of Chicago. That was her thought.
That's good.
Maybe I don't know when Chicago was on.
Yeah, 90s?
Yeah, it would have to be in the 90s.
Late 90s?
But I always toyed with the idea of getting Cybill Shepherd to play her in a kind of the older Justine now and with a walking stick.
That'd be great for a sequel. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, that's just the beginning. All that film is 90 blank pages with Cybill Shepherd with a walking stick at the end of it. I don't know what happens.
Or at the beginning. It could be bookends. Well, so last question. What was your toughest scene as both a writer and as a director? And how did you creatively push through it? So starting as a writer, what was your toughest scene on the page? Something to visualize, something that you kept coming back to over and over again. And how did you get through it?
I don't know, you know. I mean, I don't know. It's tricky. I mean, I think that I guess it would be something like the sparking point of the shooting. You know, it's having a insult that's so bad that would cause this all to kick off. And I'd written a version of it that was pretty insulting, and then Amy came along with this thing, which is, was it, I came so hard in your cousin's mouth I think I knocked some of her rotten teeth out, and you'll have to look through her stools in the hospital. And I was like, fucking what? And you know, and everyone was like, oh man, that's bad, you know. That could start a fight just by reading it out off a page rather than, you know. So that was once that was there, then it was off, and I make a point of pointing out that my wife wrote that, not me.
That's awesome. And so, what was your toughest scene as a director, and how did you get through it?
There wasn't anything particularly that stands out. I mean, there's stuff like there's particular stunts and things which are complicated, but it's not tough for me. It's more tough for the crew, you know. So, the Charlton Copley had been talked into being set on fire by the stunt crew. And so that was the whole film was shot in chronological order, except for that scene, which was shot on the last day in case he got hurt. and that's amazing. And, you know, I was looking on the monitor going, Jesus, that's an A-list actor on fire. You don't see that very often. And then you talk to people about it and go, oh, God, CG is so amazing. How did you know, the CG fire's really come on. I'm like, no, dude, he's on fire. That's it. You know, so that the theatre of how you do that is really complicated, of like rehearsal and
But directorial, there was nothing that you were worried about your coverage for all those actors on screen at once, because usually that's things that are tough for directors sometimes.
No, because it's all planned. You know, it's like that's the if there's a problem, you got caught out, but I would have had to have made a mistake months before shooting the thing. You know, that side of it. The planning side of it is fine. I mean, I can't think if there was anything I'd be worried about, it would be a tonal issue with a performance in a moment and capturing a moment. But they're also brilliant, those actors. There's not, you know, my job's pretty straightforward once you get on set. But yeah, I mean, I've had, you know, on other movies, I've had issues with where I've gone, fuck, I've not got this, or I've not covered it right. But by the time, you know, this is my sixth feature film, where, you know, I kind of know what I'm doing.
Well, you've been very generous with your time, and I cannot wait to see what you do next. Oh, Ben, cheers, thanks a lot, man.
Thank you.
And that's how the Q&A went down. Special thanks again to this episode's sponsor, ScreenCraft.org. And remember, next time you're on their site, ready to enter your script into any one of their contests, be it the comedy, horror, or fellowship contest, discount coupon code QAPODCAST, all one word, QAPODCAST, will save you 10% off your entry fee at www.screencraft.org. Of course, many thanks again to co-writer, director Ben Wheatley for being so generous with his time and coming down to chat about his latest film, Free Fire. This episode in the Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith is a copyright of Unlikely Films Incorporated in 2017. All rights reserved. And folks, I thank you again for spreading the word about Backstory.net becoming the newest place you could read the magazine very, very soon, and for checking out issue 26, our Oscars issue, on iPads around the world, and quite soon, issue 27, our Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 issue. But hey, if you'd like to show your support for this free podcast and donate so I can continue to buy new equipment and use these funds to pay for my podcast hosting fees, feel free to send a PayPal virtual tip to yogoldsmith@gmail.com. Any amount is greatly appreciated. As for your social networking needs, you could follow Yo Goldsmith on Twitter or could check out my Facebook fan page. I'm Jeff Goldsmith, the publisher of Backstory and the host of the Q&A, thanking you for tuning in and telling you to stay out of trouble. Till next week.